verse 1, discussing our ongoing discussion of the issue of Isha. This is the overview, paragraph-wise, of the purport. As we discuss in the overview of the whole issue of Isha, the first section talks about harmonizing with God. As we know, Bhaktivinoda Thakur explains that our approach to God begins with fear. Why is fear necessary? Fear is necessary for obedience. Obedience is our harmonization. So the issue of Isha also talks about, let's begin by obeying God. We have to harmonize ourselves. And after we start living in harmony with God and start experiencing the benefit of that, then we start inquiring, okay, who is this person that I am obeying and my life is becoming better by obeying? Then the next section talks about the inconceived attributes of God and how we can reconcile them through purification and spiritual advancement. So in this particular verse, Krishna talks about, or rather the Lord talks about, a very important principle. Incidentally, the Ishopanishad is actually a series of prayers offered by Swayambhuva Manu to Lord Yajna. Actually, in the 8th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, the first chapter is called as Manu, the administrator of the universe. And in that, it is described how Swayambhuva Manu renounces the world and goes into the forest, and he is standing on one hand, one foot, and performing severe austerities and offering prayers to the Lord. At that time, the Rakshasas come to attack and devour him. They see that he is a defenseless person and he is not going to resist because he is in trance. So let me attack and feast on him. So at that time, Lord Yajna appears and kills all the Rakshasas. So it is in that context that Swayambhu Manu offers these prayers. So Ishopanishad is a part of the prayer that are offered. Other prayers are offered, which were offered at that time, are described in the 8th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam. So one verse is very similar. Three lines are the same. Atma vastyam idam sarvam yatkinja jagatyam jena te vikteena punjita ma vrudha kasya siddhanam. The verse is practically identical over there. The only difference is, instead of Isha, it is Atma. Now Chakravarti Pal, in his analysis to that verse, is Atma refers to that which pervades the body. So he says, if we consider the Vishwarup of the Lord, then he is pervading as a super soul all the whole of existence. Therefore he says that the word Atma normally means soul. But we have to see that we'll be discussing this later about the rules of Sanskrit translation. So one of the schools in Sanskrit philosophy is called Mimamsa. And in Mimamsa, elaborate discussion is done about what are the ways to translate correctly and what are not valid ways of translation. So he says that one word can have many meanings. And the most important criteria for understanding the meaning of a word is the context. Even when we read sometimes a book, even if you don't know the word, from the context we can get an approximate understanding of the meaning of the word. So, Max Müller and other scholars, they completely violate this principle of contextual translation and understanding. Now, the word go refers to cow, the word go refers to senses. So, now it is said a transcendentalist should cut the senses. And cut the senses means control the senses. So they translate as, sannyasi should cut the cows and eat them. It's very absurd, it's outrageous, but this is a typical example of the kind of translation which is linguistically valid but contextually completely erroneous. Linguistically only justified, yes, but go means cow. So you have to cut the cow. But it is completely invalid from the point of view of the context. That's why Mahavishnu Maharaj, when he entered into the academia for teaching over there, one of the things which he would always emphasize with respect to Prabhupada's translations was that Prabhupada is not just translating the text, Prabhupada is also translating the context. The text and context. So if one just does a one just knows language and then he translates the text, that will be useful from the point of view of understanding it as a, if that were just a historical text, or it's a novel, or it's an entertainment book, okay, you want to know the exact linguistic meaning of that. But the scriptures are not just books of history or entertainment or novel. The scriptures are books which are lived by people for centuries. The books are a part of a culture. So when Srila Prabhupada translates, he does not translate only the text, he translates the culture. Therefore, Krishna is saying, Patram Pushpam Palam Toyam Yome Bhaktya Prayachami. So in that verse, that purport proverb, how actually Krishna will take only a little food, and how we should offer food, and how Krishna accepts the food. So now all this will not be there in the purport, in the verse itself. But what is Prabhupada doing? Prabhupada is teaching us the culture. And sometimes, in order to convey the culture, for example, I did a detailed study, comparative study of the 10th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam and Krishna Mukha, to see exactly what Prabhupada has done in a summary study. Because one Sadhurmaya summary study. Prabhupada, what do you mean by summary study? Prabhupada, summary study means I do what I want. I do what I want. But what Prabhupada wants is not musical. And actually according to the will of Krishna. So it's very interesting. Now in the Gopi Geet prayers, you know that the chapters 29 to 32 are called the Ras Panchadhyay. They're considered to be the summit of the Bhagavatam. And that chapter 31 is the prayers of the gopis in separation from Krishna. So now Prabhupada translates those prayers, and at the end of the prayers he says, in this way the gopis in separation from Krishna chanted Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Ram, Hare Ram, Ram Ram, Hare Hare. Now, when the gopis are not chanting Hare Krishna Mahamantra, there's no reference to that in the Bhagavatam. At least not in that section. How can you add something over there? So Srila Prabhupada is actually telling us how to practice that culture. You know, we can offer the Gopi Gita also, but they are very exalted devotional sentiments of devotees who are far, far above even liberation. And we are far, far below liberation. So, the practical way we can offer prayers in the same spirit is by chanting Hare Krishna. So, if you look from the textual point of view, it seems wrong. But if you look from the contextual point of view, it is perfect. But the mood is what essence is, we offer prayers to the Lord by which we invoke the presence of the Lord. That's what happens. The gopis offer the prayer, and the next chapter Krishna comes back. So that's what will happen if we chant the Hare Krishna mantra. Lord manifests it. Prabhupada Krishna dances the Natam. So the point is that translation is not just the business of a linguist, especially when it's translating scripture. Translation is the work of Acharya. And Yamadu Maharaj, in his book Searching for Vedic India, is a very practical example for this. He says that, suppose there is a book of medicine, which is written in German language. And that book of medicine has cured many people. There is a doctor who is treating the people and he has cured many, many people. And then, there is a scholar of English who learns German. And after learning German, he translates that book from German into English. He is a scholar of English, and he is a scholar of German. He translates that book into English. And there is the same doctor who has cured thousands of people of diseases by that German book of medicine. The first scholar is not a doctor, he is simply a scholar, linguist. The second is a doctor. Now he learns English and he translates that book from German to English. Now he is not a German scholar, he is either an English scholar. But whose translation will be practically more useful? The doctor's. Because the book has a purpose. And the doctor is fulfilling the purpose of the book. So when he will translate in such a way that the purpose of the book is fulfilled. So the language is important because it conveys a particular purpose. So what modern scholars try to do is, they try to divorce the text of the book from its original purpose. And this is just, let us see, without divorcing it from the purpose, let us see what the text says by itself. No, but the text is a part of a culture. The text is a part of a context. From IIT, some of you know this professor Chaudhary, he read the Srimad Bhagavatam, some section, and he got very wild. He said, Prabhupada, that is so many in the translation. He talked with Arishyam Prabhu, he talked with Gauram Prabhu, he was not satisfied with any explanations. Then I told him, he sent the mail, then I sent that mail to Ardhan Maharaj, to the Karma Prabhu and Satyaraj Prabhu. And all of them gave a very beautiful reply. And they were always satisfied by that. So, Ardhan Maharaj said, first thing, he said, yes. You know, Mr. Karmapur said that Prabhupada himself said that my English is imperfect. He says that in that shloka. He says that Tadvam Sargo Janata Vishnu. And Prabhupada, you know, you say, our attempt to present this literature in a foreign language will certainly fail. But still, we hope that people will take it seriously because it is not a matter of language, it is a matter of, it is a science of values. It is a message to be applied and to be transformed. So he says, yes, Prabhupada never claimed perfection either in his English, that his English was linguistically accurate. Then Satyaraj Prabhu explained that you have to choose. Mundane scholars can give you literal translation, Prabhupada gives you essential meaning. You choose what you want. Do you want this literal translation or do you want essential meaning? So, just like a doctor will give the literal translation. The linguistic scholar, he will just give literal translation. This word means this, this word means this. But that completely misses out on the essential meaning. So therefore, this principle which we are discussing now, it will come especially in the verses 9 to 11. I'll be discussing that once again over there. This principle of translation, how it needs to be done. And then, Ardhan Maharaj said, okay, so he said, that even if you say that Prabhupada's translation is fault, but he said, one common meaning of the word, let me translate that one. Translate, that means to explain. For example, somebody speaks in a very complicated English. And let me translate that one. That means you explain it. So Prabhupada is actually explaining to us. So the important point is, Prabhupada Chandra always satisfied that. Because you know, if we try to insist, so some devotees try to tell him that, do you think you are cleverer than Prabhupada? Do you think that you have the authority to question Prabhupada's translations? Now this sort of approach alienates intelligence. When you try to demand blind adherence, he says that I am not questioning Prabhupada, but it's objective. This verse, there is no verse which, no Sanskrit word in the verse which has this particular response. So, for example, that particular verse was that, you know, how a husband is attached to his wife and children. So, Prabhupada writes the beautiful wife and the sweet children. And then he is attached in the moment of death. So apparently there is no beautiful over there, there is no sweet over there, there is no till the moment of death there. So like that, 7-8 things which are not there, he pointed out in one verse. And he said, there are many like that in each verse. So yeah, Prabhupada is actually explaining to us in a way which we can understand. So there is a classic example that in the 7th canto, there is that verse of Prahlad Maharaj saying that, you know, it's doing the role of conditioned soul. And he's saying that my senses are attracted in all the different directions. All of you know the picture also, the ropes are pulling. So there Prabhupada, so he says that the ears are attracted to sweet music. So Prabhupada translates that the ears are attracted to cinema songs. Somebody one is cinema and cinema that Prahlad Maharaj time and cinema songs. So Prabhupada is not translating the text. He's translating the context. Yes, at that time some different kind of songs might be there. Now what are our ears attracted to? Cinema songs. So yes, we have to understand the purpose of your Prabhupada. Prabhupada, even when he was writing, if he had just wanted to become a famous author, he would have stayed in India. Because after he got the first canto published in 3 volumes, you know, the Prime Minister of India, the President of India, so many big professors endorsed his books. And once your books are endorsed by big people, then any publisher will be able to publish. In fact, if you see when Prabhupada went to America, for him publishing was very difficult. Because America publishing industry is much more organized. And so, in 62, 63, 64, the first canto was published in 3 parts originally. So first part, second part, third part were published. And Prabhupada said, I am ready to go. The next book that was published was right in 69. For 4 years there were no books. So actually, if Prabhupada simply wanted to be an author, actually going to America was detrimental to his mission. Because America is not so well known and America publishing is much more complicated. So, how the breakaway was very wonderful.
Pramana through what Prabhupada told Pramana. You have to get the books published. And even though at that time Prabhupada was quite unknown and nobody was interested. So one day he got a letter from Macmillan. He says, I want to have a copy of your book, please come. And Macmillan office was so excited. He told Prabhupada, thankfully they called us. Prabhupada says, please go and visit. So take back to the family and go. And he went to the prasadam, and he went to the office. It was an ordinary clerk in the office who said, I want a personal copy of Bhagavad Gita. And he was so heartbreakingly disappointed. So he said, what is going to happen now? And then as he was sitting there, he was in his dhoti kurta, his shaven head, suddenly this clerk got up. And he also looked around, he also got up. He said, that's the manager of our office. That's the chief man in our office. And he went inside, straight. And then suddenly, a chief man, he opened his door and came out. And he says, are you a Hindu?
He didn't want to say yes.
Actually, you know, we are publishing a book on religious classics. Yes, we publish a series of religious classics. So we have a book on the Bible, we have a book on the Quran. They are looking for a book on the Gita.
Do you have one? He said, he said,
I have one. He said, who has done it? He said, Swami. Swami from India, genuine Swami. He said, yes. So bring the book over to me. And he brought the book over. And normally, in any publishing houses to publish it, there's a lot of the rigorous editing process. Now, that means, you know, like if I write an article back to God, of course, now I am also one of the editors, so I do the same to others now. But what happens is, whenever an article comes to back to God, there are four or five editors. All of them look at the article and all of them point out, okay, this may not be good, this may not be good, we change this. To satisfy every one of them. And then it gets published. Publishing is not at all an easy thing. And you know, all the editors are professional fault finders. Trained fault finders. So, but they because they wanted to complete their religious volume set, so they decided that we will not have any of this, we will bypass the editorial process. The only editing they did was, we wanted to have a book of a standard length. All the other books were 400 pages, so this book also will be 400 pages. They said, your Swami's purpose are 2 minutes, so cut out the purpose. So, that hybrid process, that is, I had a doleful task of deciding which of the Bhaktivedanta purports are unnecessary and removing. So, they published the Macmillan Act. Once it got published, so many scholars gave very good reviews. This is actually faithful to the spirit, the devotional spirit of the Gita. And then Prabhupada published it twice with Macmillan. Then Prabhupada said, once Prabhupada's Gita got its own respect again, then we'll publish it ourselves. And then he published the unabridged version. So Macmillan Gita is available at BBK and other places, small Gita. Many of the, most of them are only translations are there, and very few purports are there. But that's how Prabhupada got his first breakthrough. So the point I'm making is that Prabhupada was not just interested in becoming famous as an author. Prabhupada wanted to teach the Gita, and Prabhupada wanted to inspire people to live the Gita. And he saw in India people were not living according to Vedic culture, So he came to America to find out who is ready to live according to the culture. So Prabhupada is not translating just the text, he is translating the context. And for him, the text is not just a, as I said, just a book for intellectual analysis and translation. For him it is a book to be lived by himself and a book to be lived by others. Yes.
Friends has to give class on Srimad Bhagavatam, and Prabhupada's wonderful translation, it was about the importance of preaching and for the benefit of others. And then I looked at the word-to-word meanings of the Sanskrit, and there was nothing about benefiting others in the word-for-word meanings. Prabhupada had interjected this. So I asked one senior devotee, how do we understand this, that Prabhupada has written the translation, but this word is not in the Sanskrit. So the senior devotee explained that actually this is one of Srila Prabhupada's ecstatic translations.
Ecstatic translations. Prabhupada said this is a purpose of emotional ecstasy.
So they all have explained this very nicely. Sometimes there are car advertisements, which say maximum mileage for each liter of petrol. So he says, Prabhupada gives us maximum mileage for each translation. Now, he's not adding something which is not there in the text entirely, but it may not be there in that particular verse.
The essential mood is the mood of compassion, which underlies everything that is in this picture.
So, Prabhupada gives us the essential culture and the essential message in practically every purport, in every translation. Yes?
Thank you.
Prabhupada, when he translates and gives purport, the message which is being conveyed by the Sukadeva Goswami has to be kept in mind, and at the same time the people whom Prabhupada is addressing also should be kept in mind. So Prabhupada, sometimes he addresses pure devotees, sometimes he addresses tarakas, and sometimes he addresses conditioned souls. So how he maintains this balance and how we can know whom he is trying to address at particular point,
Come bring it down.
What is that?
Don't you have a report? Why do you need all this? You don't have a whiteboard, sir? Okay, it will be tomorrow evening. So basically,
so you know, Prabhupada has to.
Prabhupada has a very formidable task. The task is what? His audience is living at practically animal level. You know, completely unregulated. And he has to bring them to the Gaudiya Vishnu level. So, from the human level first, animal level first, you have to bring to the human level. Prabhupada has the four regulated principles to bring us to the human level. They got not much to do with spirituality. And from there, you move to the spiritual level. Yes, there is something higher in life. And spiritual, Vedic spirituality, as is in other religions, spirituality mostly based on faith. And in Vedic religions, spirituality is based on inquiry. So, make people philosophical, Vedic. And then Vaishnava. Yes, there are so many conceptions of God. But then, you have to talk about the Gaudiya conception, the Vedic Vaishnava conception of God. And then the Gaudiya Vaishnava is Madhurya Ras. You know, it's so lofty. So Maharaj, I'm just trying to develop faith in Krishna. But now you are telling that Krishna has 16,100 wives. Now how can God have that? It's disturbing my faith. I can't understand. No person, you can't understand. Even great scholars can't understand.
So, of course, Prabhupada is often some Christian missionary who argue to.
No, why is God so lusty? How can somebody be so lusty? How can somebody so lusty be God? So Prabhupada said, why should God be deficient? If God is lusty, the proof that He is God is that He is unlimitedly lusty.
So Prabhupada was not neither apologetic or defensive. Prabhupada just stumped people by being aggressive in the most unexpected way.
So he said, yes,
everything is now, when we talk about lustiness, that is not mundane or selfish or body centered.
But the point is, all the different religions talk about God as the controller, God as the proprietor, but the understanding of God as the enjoyer is revealed only in the religious teacher. I mean, the notion might be there that God is the enjoyer, but how God enjoys, that is described only, not as the Vedic literature, not even the Vaishnava literature, only in the Gaudiya Vaishnava literature. So it's a huge task that Srila Prabhupada has. And that's why Srila Prabhupada, another thing is, you know, his audience is historically, geographically,
linguistically, culturally, philosophically, religiously, and socially different from the entire original audience. So, the original audience of the Vedic literature had a different sense of history, cyclic history. Western audience has a linear sense of history. Geographically, they can't make sense of Bhumandala and Vimala and they don't know anything about it. Culturally, the first time when the devotees got a picture of Hanuman, they asked, is this a rabbit? Is this a monkey? Is this a cat? They couldn't understand it. So, linguistically, you know, actually, devotees would, many times they would come with, they would take some, they would try to give up drugs, but still they would come and it was very heavy. They lost during class. So one time in San Francisco, Srila Prabhupada said, let us all recite the Sanskrit verses. And then the devotees became serious. Because Sanskrit was so complicated, Prabhupada say one word and make them recite. And one word and recite. And slowly they started getting the pronunciations. But, so linguistically entirely different. And not only that, religiously their understanding of God is very different. A very beautiful, you know, Harry Ruth, who was a professor in Ohio State University. He started teaching over there. Professor Howard Wheeler. So one principal called him. He says, I heard that you're talking about God in your classes. He was also had an aggressive mood of Srila Prabhupada. He said, is there any rule that you cannot talk about God in this college? No, that is not the point. We are talking about a strange conception of God. Most people don't know who is God, so how can you say that my conception of God is strange when your conception is not known? No, the point is that you are saying that God is a cowboy? He's not a cowboy, a cowherd boy.
You have a cowboy movie, they wear hats and go on horses and shoot. Like a cowboy, a cowboy boy.
And is God, you think God is black?
Because they have the whole white, like, black description going on.
No, God is blue.
He got completely psyched up. So, religiously, they are entirely different.
Yeah, but they couldn't make out. What are those persons? What are they talking about? So, culturally, man-woman mixing was so common in the West. And Srila Prabhupada, no Vyasacharya has given Brahman Diksha to women. But Prabhupada gave Brahman Diksha. Why? Because the essential principle is that everybody should be engaged in bhakti. In the Vedic culture, women can be engaged at home, as homemakers and as kids, as mothers. But in the Western culture, the upbringing is so difficult for them. So different for them, that for women to be just fit in that role is very difficult. Because any way you want to engage in service, engage in service. So if you want your own creatures, then you give Brahman Diksha also to them. So, what Srila Prabhupada accomplished was practically impossible. You know, so much gap in the... Now, this talks basically about what? You know, the practice, what level of consciousness they were and what level of consciousness Prabhupada wanted to live. But apart from that also there were so many barriers. So it was extremely difficult for Srila Prabhupada to translate. And therefore, Srila Prabhupada focuses on the essential principles. Essential philosophical principles and the essential spiritual practice, essential devotional practices. And Prabhupada does not get too much into technical details. And Prabhupada does not strive for linguistic accuracy. It is not that Srila Prabhupada can't do that. But that will detract from his mission. Because the Vedic scriptures are so complicated that when Prabhupada decides to go into grammatical analysis, then the grammar itself will take 12 years to learn. So Prabhupada, that is not the essential purpose that Prabhupada is coming. That's what Prabhupada's character says. Vyavasayatmika buddhi eke hai. See, one important Maharaj, Udayana Maharaj told the point, he said, you know, if, a very nice point, I like this very much, Jolly also like this, he said, that you know, if Prabhupada wanted to cheat you, then Prabhupada would not have given you the word to word translation. Prabhupada knows what he is doing and he is not hiding what he is doing from you. He is giving you the word to word translation and then he gives you the translation. So therefore, Prabhupada is giving us something extra based on his compassion. And he's not hiding it. Very convincing. You know, most scholars, when they translate, nobody gives word to a translation. And then they can play around with it. Because most people do not know something. But Prabhupada uses the word to a translation, and then he gives the translations. And then you can see, okay, this is here, this is not there. And actually a question will come. And when the question comes, then you will understand Prabhupada's compassionate intention. So Prabhupada is not hiding it. Yes, Prabhupada is surely doing something which is the text which is, in one sense, unconventional. Normally most translators won't do it. But Prabhupada is not hiding it. Prabhupada is putting all the cards on the table and letting us see what is there. So that we understand his purpose. Yes.
So when I hear about the knowledge of our Gaudiya Vaishnava philosophy, this knowledge is going to be much, much higher than compared to the philosophies offered by other Western other religions and all. So this channel is going to be way high. So, I think that's so apparent actually, the concept of very basic thing that the conception of God is very controlled. But like when I hear about other religions, they tell me that just portraying God as a cruel person. That means if you don't follow them, you will be doomed to hell forever like that. So now, after hearing so much, the question that comes to my mind is, how is it that the philosophy is being so rich and you know, like so explanatory without demanding much faith under other religions? Still, why is it that we didn't reach to the intelligentsia of the society or to the high of people like, who are like the actual society, like still we more or less like being appreciated by only our circles, you know, like why is it that we couldn't get spread to the whole world like that, you know? Not
interested. Very good question. The philosophy is so glorious and it is not reached everywhere. Good. Answer for itself be a whole class. But I tell briefly, one is no right propaganda, to it, lot of wrong propaganda. Wrong propaganda. So, you see, somehow, India has been under foreign rule for more than 1,000 years. And the Islamic period was very bloody. Very, very bloody. The Jews made such a big issue out of 4 million Jews being killed during the Second World War, some of the first. In the Islamic rule, 40 million Hindus were killed. 40 million is how much? 4 crore. And these are what is documented in the official records. And actually, for this we'll be discussing more in the YouTubership section, which will come there in the verses 5-6. You know, Islam is completely, according to Islam, worship of idols is not just bad, it is the greatest sin against God. And therefore, when they conquered India, they just went about destroying not only the temples, but their idea is that anybody who doesn't accept Allah as God, anybody who doesn't accept Muhammad as the last and the best prophet to God, he is a kafir and he deserves to be killed. So it was. And it was not only the kafirs deserve to be killed, especially those who are preaching false religion, they should be killed first. Aurangzeb's rule, he had a rule that every day his soldiers had to get 20,000 tender threads. Either 20,000 Brahmins had to be killed or converted. Then cut sacred threads had to be back brought back. So the intelligentsia, this is well documented history. Aurangzeb's brother was Darashiko. And Darashiko was a very open minded person. He is the first person who has translated the Upanishads into Persian. And even now the Upanishads are there in the Delhi Museum. And it is another stamp of the Muslim Empire. But what happened was, he appreciated the Upanishad wisdom quite a bit. And that, although he was a righteous ruler, he was a noble person, but Aurangzeb, because when he appreciated the Vedic literature, the mullahs felt very angry about that. And Aurangzeb was not very much loved by anyone. But Aurangzeb took the religious anger of the mullahs and he had a mutiny and he had Darashiko killed. The cold mullah, his own brother. The point is that, you know, Islamic rule was very, very bad. it's a remarkable miracle that many cultures survive in all. The Malaysia, Indonesia, that was very culture over there. It's gone completely. Completely. Buddhism also, quite proud. Very few remains of Buddhism are there. So the fact that the Vedic culture survived itself is a miracle. And most of the places where Islam came, now Islam has a spiritual part and a political part. Mohammed life itself has a spiritual part and a political part. But the followers of Mohammed have mostly taken his political part. And they have focused on that as the essence of Islam. So Islam as it has been historically practiced is more a religion that is a search for political power than a search for spiritual truth. And the obtaining of political power is considered to be like the proof of Allah's grace. So they consider, the Muslims consider, even now the Muslims consider that a land, like they don't want to be the Ramjan Mohammed place because they think that a place where mosque has been built, that forever belongs to Allah. That cannot be given to a false god. And that claim is not only for the mosque. That claim is for all of India. They say all of India was an Islamic land because Darul Islam. Darul Islam is the land of Islam. And it is our duty to Allah to return what belongs to Allah back to Allah. So, you know, Islamic rule was very big. And we see this even Chaitanya Charitamrita. But the way Krishna Goswami describes it, he said, we realize the glory of Haridas Thakur, not the intolerance of the Muslims. Haridas Thakur, what is his crime? According to Islam, if anybody leaves Islam, that is considered apostasy, that is considered betrayal of God. And the punishment for leaving Islam is death. So Haridas Thakur's only crime was that he had left Islam, he was chanting some other god. Haridas Thakur spoke very practically. He said, the same God is talked about in the Quran and the Quran. And he said that, you know, the Lord inspires different people to glorify in different ways. But they didn't hear anything. So point one is that historically, the Vedic culture has been desecrated, like anything. And that was the Islamic period. And after that, the British period. When the British period came, everything became much more special. But the reason for that was, the Britishers were not so much in number. The Muslims, they came in large numbers and they converted also. Now we see, actually, we can't only think the Britishers and the Christians and the Muslims, because the Hindus were also fanatical. I'll come to that easily. Fanatical not in the sense of attacking and controlling others, but fanatical in their own puritanical nature. You know, Subhubi Rai, one, somebody sprinkled some water on it, and poor fellow, there's a Hindu or Muslim. It's so ridiculous. You know, when Kashmir came to India, something like 50 lakh Muslims who were living in Kashmir, they said, no, hey, Kashmir has come to India, you would like to become Hindus. And anyway, our great grandfathers are Hindus, they're forced to convert by the sword. So then the matter was referred to, they sent a letter to Nehru. So Nehru referred it to the Hindu Mahasabha, the Maharashtra Sabha in Banaras. And the Mahasabha told them that actually the Hindu Dharma is so great. And the only way that a person can become a Hindu is by his karma when he takes birth in a Hindu people. So tell them to practice Islam nicely, in the next life they will become Hindus. Hindus. And know what happened? Kashmir is birth Hindu. No, so that one, so we can't just blame others. And Hindu Brahminism, it's a very great distress. In Maharashtra, Shivaji Maharaj and his followers, they fought so fiercely against Islam. So at one time Aurangzeb sent his whole army practically to try to attack. And they were, what they would do is, you know, Shivaji Maharaj was staying in a fort high above and they would penetrate that. So what they would do is, they would just start desecrating all the holy places on the plains. There was Tulgapur, there was Pandharpur, and all the holy places they would desecrate that. Because that will provoke the Hindu sentiment. And then they will come down. So basically, many factors are there, but what happened was Shivaji Maharaj and Nirali Palkar, both of them were arrested. And Sambhaji Maharaj was Shivaji Maharaj, and that was much later. You know, he was very brutally, you know, for 10 days what Aurangzeb was doing was ripping his skin and putting salt on it. Ripping his skin and putting salt on it. And so he converted to Islam or not. On the 7th day, he literally gouged out his eyes. And 10th day, practically, you know, there's no skin left on his body. And finally, he died. So this is all historically documented. It's not something just... So anyway, what happened was, when Shivaji Maharaj somehow escaped, Netaji Palghar couldn't escape him. 3 days he was very severely tortured. And when he was tortured, finally he converted to Islam. And when he converted to Islam, then he was made a general in the Muslim army and sent to Afghanistan. So from there he ran away. And he came back to Shivaji Maharaj. When he came back to Shivaji Maharaj, Shivaji Maharaj did a Mutashuddhi Yajna and made him a Hindu again. And when he did that, the Brahmanas of Python sent a long letter to Shivaji Maharaj saying, don't defile Hindu Dharma by bringing a Muslim back into Hindu Dharma. Shivaji Maharaj didn't care for them only. They accepted Netaji Palghar back. But the point was, Hindu Brahmanism was very, very difficult. It was very unfortunate. So, the Hindu Brahmanism, the sheer narrow-mindedness created a lot of alienation. So it is in terms of the puritanical rituals, Prabhupada writes in one purport that when people were converting, the Christians were converting and the Muslims were converting, what happened? The Hindu Brahmin said, okay, you are as it is, lokas, if you want to become leksha, go to him, you don't care. So the Brahminical attitude was self-righteous and corrupt. That is also a problem, but I am only one side of the story. Now there were also many upright Brahmanas and saintly people, who are not in Brahmanas. See, especially in the Islamic rule, what happened was, bhakti became more prominent. Because all the tangible symbols of religion, whether they are yajnashalas or temples, they were designated by Muslims. And that's why the bhakti in the form of musical songs, dancing, music. If you see, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, he told Goswamis to build temples in Vrindavan. He did not tell Advaita Acharya to build any temple in Vrindavan. And Navamsisha was a very cool room. So, what happened basically, there is everywhere in India, whether it's Tukaram Maharaj in Maharashtra or Narasimha Mehta in Gujarat or you say Shankar Dev in Assam or you see Mirabai in Rajasthan or Tulsidas and others in Uttar Pradesh and North India. In South India we have Pundalik and others. So, all in Bengal we have Pandas Thakur, Bhaktivinoda Thakur, to cover much later. But even before that, Chandigarh, Vidyapati, Jayadeva Goswami. Basically, through music, dance, Shravan Kirtan. So, bhakti in that form became very prominent. So, where there are no visible symbols of religion, shall be dissipated. People can just come and sing, chant and dance together and sing and express their emotion. So, historically, that was a big problem. Because the morale, practically speaking, the morale of the Vedic culture was very severely damaged by the Islamic repression. And after that, when the European rule came, they were more insidious. You know, what they did was, rather than, because they were few in number, rather than forcibly converting, they tried to intellectually convert. And that was through misinterpretation of the literature. So, that, they have done a huge amount of job in that. So what happened is that, like yesterday I was telling, anybody who does a work first, he is considered authority. Shankaracharya is the first person to write a commentary on Vedanta Sutra. Then he is a commentary for the most authority. So like that, these Western Indologists were the first to translate the Vedic scriptures into English. And that's why their translations are considered the most authority. And unfortunately, the Hindu Brahmins, they said, our language is so great, Sanskrit. And the English is rich bhasha. We will not translate our language, our letter, Greek literature into English. And if you don't translate, somebody else is going to translate. And they will translate with their agenda, which will lead to mistranslation. So, the amount of mistranslations that are there about the Greek literature, now all of us are very fortunate. And sometimes I used to think, if we had religious studies. In India, in the academic level, there is no religious study, there is no philosophy study. The best thing is that we would have learned so much about our culture. But actually, if you go to the religious studies department, there is so much garbage. For example, historically, Western historically, most of the temples in India were Brahmins. And what is their logic for that? They say actually in Jagannath temple, there are thousands of Devidasis who are sitting. The Devidasis are by no stretch of imagination to be considered society girls. They are men, they are chaste, they were virgin girls. Who live for the pleasure of Jagannath and dance for his pleasure. And so we have the reference to that in Kamandra has passed time in Chaitanya Charitamrita Chaitan, 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 Chaitan. Kamandra was decorating them. So they were virgin girls, they meant only for Jagannath's mission. But this is all this, you know, there are unmarried girls, they basically brought them, they brought them out. So now that's the one the oldest and most sacred temple, that is called the Prophet, and nobody challenges. Actually nobody challenged for a long time. So like that there are horrendous misrepresentations of Vedic culture and Vedic philosophy, which came up because of the Western Indologist translating. And the predominant image of India, even now, in the West, is a very primitive country filled with blind beliefs and harsh customs. Sati has been stopped in India long ago. But even now, the idea is India is a culture where sati is practiced, where women are killed for dowry, where children are killed, where the mothers kill their child if they find the child is a girl. And these sort of throwback images are there in the West. So, and most of India, India's educated elite learns about Indian culture from the West, not from the practitioners of Indian culture. Why? Because we don't learn anything in our textbooks. So what is the second source? The second source is the media. Is the newspapers or is the television. And what comes in the newspaper and television is basically recycled from what is taught by the West. So therefore, I mean, when we were talking about the kind of misrepresentations that are there, but it's horrible. Now, the prominent textbook on Ganesh in the West says that actually Shiva and Brahma had a fight and Brahma cut off the phallus, the reproductive organ of Shiva. And then to further insult him, he took the reproductive organ and stuck it on the face of Ganesh. And that is Ganesh's so-called trunk. And this is published in textbooks of Hinduism. Now there is no business anywhere in scripture. But nobody is challenging that. So because of such horrendous misrepresentations, now most people think that now, for example, there is a lot of good work here. But ultimately Christianity, our agenda was to convert people to Christianity. That's why, you know, the Sisters of Charity spread the notion that the Hindus have been so indoctrinated by their priests into believing this irrational law of karma that even when we offer them food to eat, they are told that they are being hungry because of their bad karma. And therefore, they should not interfere with the law of karma and take food. Whether the thing happened or not, this is certainly not happening here or not. This is the predominant image. So most intellectual people think that the law of karma was invented by the Brahmins to keep the lower caste suppressed. Nothing to do with it. It's a standard conception. So let's come. Read this little bit. That's why. So what has happened is the Christian missionaries, they didn't, I mean, they studied the Vedic literature quite a bit. But they studied with a completely ulterior motive. And so their misrepresentation was still there. Devanand Maharaj in searching for Vedic India explains elaborately this point. Now generation for generation for generation, the same misrepresentation was going on. So, yeah, let me complete this. So, for example, one of the common themes which there is the Aryan invasion theory. The Aryan invasion theory, Prabhupada will talk about it. Now we are discussing it, diverting a little bit from our subject. But anyway, we'll have to discuss this later. So let's discuss it now. The Aryan invasion theory was what? That when the Europeans came to India, they found that there's such an ancient culture over here. Ancient and advanced culture over there. Advanced in what terms? Many terms. Now, you know, actually there are many palaces in Italy. The Italy's Prince Palace, even now it's like one of the French palaces or the Italian palaces are there. You probably know about the name, I don't remember. Those palaces, even now they are like antiques, but the whole palace, there is no toilet. There is no bathroom, there is no toilet. So the members of the royal family would just go behind the curtains and do their business and the servants would come and clean. That was the level of hygiene. And if you look at Mohenjo-daro and Harappa, which are at least 2,500 years, there are big public and private bathing places. So according to Western civilization itself, if a civilization, Western civilization standard, if a civilization has a bathing place, it's considered the advanced civilization. So the point was that when they found these Mohenjo-daro, Harappa and other things, it's a very advanced civilization. But they already had a very deeply ingrained European inferiority complex. We are the greatest. So how could these pagans, these Hindus, as they would call them, how could they be more advanced than us? So they come up with the theory that actually it was our own ancestors who came many years ago, and these all of you were tribals, but our ancestors came and civilized you. And although we civilized you, again you have gone back to tribals. Now we have come to again civilize you. So that was the idea of the Aryan theory, invasion theory, was primarily used to legitimize British rule in the eyes of the Indian masses by making it appear as if they are reenacting an ancient historical benevolent event. First of all, the event was not historical and their intention was not benevolent. But that's one of this propaganda is there, and because of that, you know, India is fractured. Many South Indians, they think we are Dravidians. We are the original residents of this land of India. And there many, if in South India, because of half of South India doesn't know, a lot of anti-Brahminical, anti-Hindu, anti-very sentiment over there. And that is completely based on this illusion. So actually, Dravidians were living and all the very culture was also living. This Aryan invasion theory has no basis in fact. Because there is not only, there are several reasons, you know, if the Aryans were tribals who came just with their, if the Aryans were just not tribals, nomads who came from traveling along, you know, how can nomads have make literature in a language whose grammar requires 12 years to master? Possible. Nomads are traveling from place to place. They can basically they can't even learn basic language or do basic art. How can they write exquisite poetry in a language whose grammar requires 12 years to use? It's a complete hoax. But it's been there. So yes. So I would say that the history. It now, we should not just be hateful towards Christians or Muslims or anyone like that. You have to understand that this is the effect of Kali. And Kali acts through different agents. But then, the purpose of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's descent and the purpose of the Vaishnava Acharyas is to counter the influence of Kali and to rescue the conditioned souls. So historically speaking, what Srila Prabhupada achieved is miraculous. In the short time that he has been there, and how he has countered it is remarkable. So what we as devotees understand is we have glorious philosophy with us, but we have to reach it to more and more people. And we are doing it through our college teaching, we are doing it through our distribution, we are doing it through our temple construction, but we have to do it much more on a vigorous scale. Because the public profile of our movement till now is more of a cultural movement than an intellectual movement. Because we are the Hare Krishna people, seen as the people who dance in the streets, they are the people who build temples, they are the people who do yatra, which is nice. But most people don't know that we are sacred, no? So if we now, especially what we are doing in voice, it's very good. We are getting into new people. But we have to do it in a much, much broader and more intense scale. And if we do that, surely, the Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's prediction will come true, and all the injustices that have been done to Vedic culture, to Vedic literature, will be corrected. But that is our mission. So Sautra Maharaj writes in one of his books, you know, if you see all the obstacles that are there in Kali Yuga, we feel preaching Krishna consciousness is mission impossible. But he says, if you remember that Krishna, this is Krishna's mission, then you will understand it's not mission impossible, it is mission unstoppable. Because Krishna is all power, so it is mission unstoppable. But we have to do our part in it. We all this started from Isha Vastam and Atma Vastam. That difference. I was talking about translation. and understanding the essential culture and context in which the translation is to be done. Yes, let's go over the purport, translation purport. Who would like to read?
ईशादिदं सर्वं यत्किञ्चिदं जगत् तेन शक्तेन भुञ्जेत मा वृथा कस्य निर्धनम्.
Everything animate or inanimate that is in the universe is controlled and owned by the Lord. One should therefore accept only those things necessary for himself, which are set aside as his quota, and one should not accept other things, knowing well to whom they belong.
Purport.
Vedic knowledge is infallible because it comes down to the perfect accepted suggestion of spiritual masters. Beginning with the Lord Himself. Since He spoke the first word of Vedic knowledge, the source of this knowledge is transcendental. The words spoken by the Lord are called Aparusheya, which indicates that they are not delivered by any mundane person. A living being who lives in the mundane world has four defects. First, he is certain to commit mistakes. Second, he is subject to illusion. Third, he has a propensity to cheat others. And fourth, the senses are imperfect. No one with these four imperfections can deliver perfect knowledge. The Vedas are not produced by such an imperfect creature. Vedic knowledge is originally imparted by the Lord into the heart of Brahma, the first created living being. And Brahma in turn disseminated his knowledge to his sons and disciples who have handed it down through history. Since the Lord is Purnam, all perfect, there is no possibility of this being subjected to the laws of material nature, which he controls. However, both the living entities and the inanimate objects are controlled by the laws of nature, ultimately by the Lord's potency. This Ishvarupanishad is part of the Yajurveda, and consequently it contains the information concerning the proprietorship of all things existing within the universe.
So Prabhupada is explaining here. Yeah. The Vedic knowledge comes from the Lord. It is infallible. And when we talk about Vedic knowledge, it is not so much, there are also many details in it. But the essential is the principles. So the principles are universal and they are eternal. So one such principle which Srila Prabhupada is talking about is the proprietorship of the Supreme Lord. So this information that actually God is the proprietor of everything is eternal truth, and that is what the Ishvarupanishad is going to talk about. Now, in the modern society, the modern psyche means way of thinking, is so self-centered that people just say like when different countries have gone to Antarctica and they have planted their flag on Antarctica and they say this part of Antarctica belongs to us. This part of Antarctica belongs to us. This part of Antarctica belongs to us. So India also has this part of Antarctica saying that this belongs to us. And similarly when they so-called claim that they have gone to the moon, what are the first thing that they did on the moon? Put the flag of their country over there. So as if that means the idea is that if there is nobody that I can see who is claiming proprietorship, then I claim proprietorship. So, it's something which is very antithetical to not just the Vedic worldview, but to any common sense worldview. That actually, if we didn't create this world, we didn't create the resources in it, so how can we claim that they belong to me? Just because apparently nobody else is claiming it, that doesn't mean that we can lay claim on it. You know, see, human society has made tremendous progress, tremendous growth in the last 300-400 years since science and technology developed. But this growth is like the growth of a cancer cell. A cancer cell grows rapidly. But the growth of a cancer cell is actually self-centered and self-destructive. Self-centered means, see, when cancer grows in the body, what happens? That cancer actually grows so disproportionately fast that it prevents the other cells from not only growing but from even functioning normally. And because of that, eventually the cancer cells, by their growth, by their self-centered growth, they cause the death of the organism in which they are living. And when they cause the death of the organism in which they are living, they can't live without that organism. So they end up killing themselves also. So therefore, the self-centered growth leads to murder of the host organism, and it leads to suicide also. So like that, we human beings are growing like cancer on this planet. And we are making certain species extinct, many species endangered. We are polluting the air, the atmosphere, the water, the land. Everything we are polluting. And what is happening is, the ecologists call this the human footprint on the planet. You know, what all is humanity exploiting from nature? It is so great that because of this, other species are not able to live, and as the ecological balance will get more and more disturbed, we will eventually be not able to live. So, as I say, this tena tek tena bhujita is extremely important. It's not that the cell in the body is not supposed to grow. Yes, surely it is going to grow. So, it is not that very critical. It should not make progress. Yes, we should make progress, but it should not be disproportionate progress, which is short-sighted. And which is destructive in the long run. That's a balanced progress. It's not that maybe culture was very primitive or backward. That time also, there were grand palaces and there was comfortable living also. Those were transcendentalists, if they wanted, they could live in austerity. But the kings had fabulous facilities, and the ordinary citizens had reasonable facilities for their life. Maybe see, Ravana had his Pushpak Viman. But the Pushpak Viman was not creating any tail of smoke when it was passing by. So it was using natural principles. So the point is that it's not that a modern society, it's not that Vedic culture is anti-progressive, but it is about balanced progress. Progress in the material realm in a way that does not hamper the future, material future of the planet, and also balance progress in a spiritual sense. So both have to be there. That's why this data that we have is such an important question. We humans arrive on the planet, but it's only to our quota. If we try to trade beyond our quota, then it is we are growing a cancer cell and we will cause ruination. So now in the next purport, next paragraph, Srila Prabhupada will explain in a very interesting logical way why is the Lord the proprietor of everything. Who would like to read?
The Lord's proprietorship over everything within the universe is confirmed in the 7th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, where para and apara prakriti are discussed. The elements of nature, earth, water, fire, air, ether, mind, intelligence and ego, all belong to the Lord's inferior material energy, apara prakriti, whereas the living being, the organic energy, is his superior energy or para prakriti. Both of these faculties or energies are beneficial from the Lord. Ultimately, He is the controller of everything that exists. There is nothing in the universe that does not belong to either the para or the apara faculty. Therefore, everything is the property of the Supreme Being.
So what is the logic? How are we doing the property? The Prabhupada's logic is Shastra Bhulam. It's based on scripture. The scripture is saying that the matter consists of two. This material world has two components, matter and spirit. And matter and spirit both are the energies of God. And therefore everything in this world is the property of God. So, now in the Upanishads are generally thought of as impersonalistic. However, the Upanishads are not entirely impersonalistic. See, the Vedic culture is user-friendly. It offers user-friendly spirituality. User-friendly spirituality means what?
that according to the psychophysical nature, according to likes and dislikes of a person, spirituality is custom made. So for those who are longing for love, the Vedic literature talk about how there is a God of love who loves his devotee so much. He has wanted to keep attraction. But for those who are tied out with relationships, so every relationship that they have experienced has led to frustration and disappointment. You tell them that the relationship is in the spiritual world. I don't want to go to spirituality. For them, there is a description of the Brahma Jyoti. Shanti, Shanti, Shanti. So normally they say the Shanti three times. Does anyone know why three times? Because there are three pleasures in this world. So Adhyatmik Klesh Shanti, Adi Bhautik Klesh Shanti, Adi Devik Klesh Shanti. Right. So for those who are fed up with relationships, now being fed up with material relationships can also be a starting point or a launching pad for spirituality. But for such people who are fed up with material relationships, for to talk with them about spiritual relationships can be very discouraging for them. So for them, there's an impersonal aspect of what is talking about. Yes, we can be peaceful, we can be quiet, we can have the relief and joy of silence and serenity. Yes, this is what I want. So Upanishads are meant to attract that kind of thing. Upanishads often start by talking in impersonal terms. But eventually they end by talking about personality. So why they talk about impersonal sense in the beginning? Because people who are fed up with material personality, they say, oh, this is what I'm looking for. But gradually towards the end they will drop the personal side. So we have to see the whole section in context, in continuity. Somebody takes one verse out of its context. So for example, say one of your preachers, so one of you goes to a ward for a bonding program and you come back. I said, in the bonding program, nobody was wearing dhoti kurta. Does that mean everybody was naked? Obviously not. Then you know they were coming in short pants. You were worried, why they are coming in short pants? Why the boy not serious enough to wear dhoti kurta? Nobody was wearing. That doesn't mean that you are not wearing any clothes. So when they say God does not have form, that doesn't mean that you have no form. It does not have any material form. So the point is that we have to see the full information, not just rip verses out of their context and try to hold them as teaching the ultimate truth. So here, I am talking about all this. If you read the next paragraph now, see Prabhupada talks about Krishna without mentioning the word Krishna. Why? Because Upanishads are read by people who are having impersonal tendencies. And you bring the personality of God in, yes, this is for sentimentalists, this is not for us. You want higher level. So Prabhupada talks about everything about Krishna without using the word Krishna. In fact, in the Ishopanishad, if you do a search, Prabhupada practically most of the time uses the word God and Lord. Practically nowhere uses the word Krishna. What the Prabhupada is doing is, the Upanishads are generally in impersonal territory. So Prabhupada is going into impersonal territory and he is using impersonal language. But he is teaching personal concepts. That's what Prabhupada is very intelligent leader. See the next sentence now. Next paragraph in the first one.
After 100 Upanishads, only 10 speak about impersonal creature, as speak about personal creature. And Shankaracharya, even when he wrote his commentary, he wrote only on those 10. And they are different from the general. They don't go to Shvedaskar Krishna and Chandragupta Krishna and all these things, because they speak more of personalistic kind of things. Only 10 predominantly speaks of impersonal thing. At least, even as per their understanding, then the Ishwar Krishna is one of the 10. So they stick to this 10 only, and they are different from the 10. So, how can
just like there are 18 Puranas and there are many Upupuranas. So the Upupuranas may also teach many things, but they are not like standard sources of Praman, sources of proof or reference within the Vedic circles. So like that, whenever there is philosophical debate, there are 10 principles of Upanishads which are considered to be the most primary. And we don't have to worry that we cannot prove personalism based on these 10. We can prove personalism even based on these 10 Upanishads.
And of course, there are other people like Gopal Tapani Upanishad and others are exclusively personalistic. So yes, there are Upanishads which are personalistic also. But as I was telling earlier, when we have to debate, we have to debate according to what are the sources respected by both the parties. When we talk about science, we have to talk, refer to scientists. So like that, when you want to talk about the teaching of Upanishads, we have to look at those Upanishads which are accepted by Sarvamanya Pramana, by all parties. And our strength is that, even on the basis of the Upanishads, which they consider as authoritative, we can prove personally. What to speak of the other Upanishads.
So, there is sometimes the Vedic literature says that these are the main Upanishads, these are the main Puranas, or is it just a
Upanishad? So, like the main Upanishad, other Upanishad, this is talking about the Muktik Upanishad. Muktik Upanishad. I can show that it's talked about somewhere. So, the principle for Upanishad and other Upanishads is talked about. Yeah, so, let's leave this support now. Very interesting how Prabhupada is writing this. Because
God, the Supreme Being, the Absolute Personality of Godhead, is the complete person. He has complete and perfect intelligence to adjust everything by means of his different potencies. The Supreme Being is often compared to a fire, and everything organic and inorganic is compared to the heat and light of that fire. Just as fire distributes energy in the form of heat and light, the Lord displays his energy in different ways. He thus remains the ultimate controller, sustainer and dictator of everything. He is the possessor of all potencies, the knower of everything and the benefactor of everyone. He is full of inconceivable opulence, power, fame, beauty, knowledge and renunciation.
He is talking about six opulences also. By the way, put it in such a way.
First he says about organic and inorganic. It sounds so from scientific terminology. It is organic and inorganic energy. Basically, organic refers to living. Inorganic means non-living. So Prabhupada is using, if you see Prabhupada's expertise in language, you can see it also in that book. What is that book Prabhupada wrote? Israeli Development. He was a scientific jargon over there.
Talking to people.
Matter, anti-matter universe. Now, Sri Prabhupada will give, so after talking about how God is the proprietor of everything, then what about us? Then we have a principle called quota. Quota based sharing. This quota has got nothing to do with the educational quota for the scheduled caste and scheduled tribes. The word quota has got quite a bad name. People get a little frightened when they hear about quotas. But here, Prabhupada says this is a natural system of division, and he will give a very practical example from nature.
In the next paragraph. Example of quota
from nature. Yeah. Who next will be?
One should therefore be intelligent enough to know that except for the Lord, no one is the proprietor of anything. One should accept only those things that are set aside by the Lord as his quota. The cow, for instance, gives milk, but she does not drink that milk. She eats grass and straw, and her milk is designated as food for human beings. Such is the arrangement of the Lord. We should be satisfied with those things He has kindly set aside for us, and we should always consider to whom those things we possess actually belong.
Yes, so give an example of a cow. Now, nature, we see that all living beings, if they are left to their natural tendencies, they will follow certain ways of behavior. Now, a tiger, even if hungry, will not eat grass. A cow, even if it's hungry, will not eat flesh. Therefore, this principle we can see very much in nature. And say Prabhupada is now, we talk about, okay, now what is in our, we should not encroach and what is not beyond us. But what is it that we also should remember who it belongs to.
So let's come to
the next paragraph of all. You know, human possession of the, it's the earth, it's very much wrong.
Take for example, our dwelling, which is made of earth, wood, stone, iron, cement and so many other material things. If we think in comes of Sri Shukrishar, we must know that we cannot produce any of these building materials ourselves. We can simply bring them together and transform them into different shapes by our labor. The labor cannot claim to be a proprietor of the thing just because he has worked hard to manufacture it.
Even in technology, this principle is nonsense at the gross level, very easy to understand. Like now all of you did the renovation of the temple altar and the temple premise. So certain laborers came and worked and they did the work, but just by doing their work, they can't claim this is our temple now. So now, this is certainly true, but the claim of proprietorship also extends to such a level. The scientists, ultimately when they make some technology, what are they doing? Just manipulating matter and energy at a such a level. So, they can't claim that this particular technology belongs to me. This particular technology, ultimately, even if we have got electronics, whether they call technology or whatever, it's all ultimately processing of processing of matter according to mechanisms which are already there in nature. So, but even this human energy of proprietorship is so much now. In America, there are organizations patenting yogasanas. So this yogasana nobody can do anywhere in the world unless they pay us for doing this yogasana. So because of this, the Indian government has now made a project. They are going through all the traditional scriptures which are there on yoga. And they are saying all these yogasanas which are talked about in our scriptures, they are public, they are in the public domain. Nobody can copyright them. But a lot of yogasanas are being copyrighted. Now, in the West, you know, this copywriting has become such a serious menace. And many of the brands, these types of crops, grains, which are traditionally grown in India, some manufacturing company takes the right, and then the poor farmers in India, for generations, have been manufacturing that. So you cannot manufacture it without paying us, because these are copyright. These are not patent, not copyright, patent, that's it. What is the patent? It's our patent. Yes? Mike?
Reading a book on Eric about young entrepreneurs in India, they are not healthy people. This is your fellow who was at a washing cups earlier now. Now he has opened a Sandipal Dosa Plaza, a shop. So successful, we made multiple outlets in India. And they are speaking to the dosas now. They call Manchir and the Sajid Dosa, different names he gave. And nobody can be in India can make that dosa actually now. He is the fourth proprietor. Even for food also, you name something, and now nobody can touch. Just like pizza is a brand name. Pizza is giving branding to the dairy foods also. And now already people are now producing that, but whatever is done now is proprietorship. At least, that in the combination of Indo, South Indian, Chinese combination, nobody can do it. He has given that name. He has taken patents now. And has opened outlets all over.
So ridiculous sometimes, you know? There was a big patent and still the battle was won. They want to patent turmeric. Turmeric. Now, nobody will use it in Haldi afterwards. The battle is going on still the patent. Turmeric has been used in the Western culture. Spices are not used much. Indian food is filled with spices. And because in the West spices are not used, so they didn't know how to make delicious food. That's why they would have to cut animals and then eat them and then that's the recipe. So the Prabhupada went to the West and he introduced vegetarianism. At that time, people's idea of if you want to eat vegetarian food, they thought if you have to eat vegetarian food, that means you have to eat vegetables. What did you do with vegetarian food? So many foods. You know, even in the vegetarian movement, the vegan movement, they also acknowledge that actually the pioneer of the modern vegetarian movement was the Hare Krishna movement. Because they actually provided a satisfactory vegetarian alternative to non-vegetarian food. Unless you offer people an alternative, people cannot take up vegetarian food. So now vegetarian food has also become a big fad and it's popular. So Prabhupada will talk about vegetarianism a little bit later. But this patenting can sometimes go to ridiculous levels. Yes,
Mr. You should
patent water and air. Yeah. Patenting Bhagavad Gita. Yeah, actually,
there is once human beings start claiming proprietorship, and there is no limit to how far you can go and claim proprietorship. So, And the whole idea now is that we do organ transplant. It's even organ donation. When I die, I will give my eyes to somebody else. And it's fine, the sentiment is good. But the problem with the sentiment is you don't know what that person is going to do with those eyes. So actually this property is what doesn't belong to us, it was given to us by nature. And then goes back to nature. So of course if organ donation is done for a devotee, actually good. But if I'm doing it for a non-devotee, then we have to be careful that we have to get the karmic consequences also. It's not that we are uncompassionate. It's that we have to be intelligent. By being compassionate also. Yes, please. In the 16th chapter, is the mentality of property experience? Very much. We talk about expanding property. Idam adhya maya labdham imam prapte manorata. Idam asthitam apne bhushiti punarvanam. This much I have brought in, and this much more I will obtain by my schemes. And then anybody who obstructs me in obtaining this, asava maya atavishatru anishe chaparano. This by any, I have killed. And he is saying, I will kill in the future. When I first read this section, I was thinking this is describing some underworld dawn. Typical mentality, it is very graphic. Yeah, very much. Demoniac mentality means whatever we see it is meant for our enjoyment. So Ravana, any woman who would see, give her mind to her. Ramba told, I am like your daughter, I am like your daughter. Perfect order, I want to enjoy. That's the demoniac mentality. The proprietorship ultimately means one wants to be enjoyed. But what does, why does one want to be the proprietor? So now, yes, we can discuss the human policy.
In modern society, there is always a great quarrel between the laborers and capitalists. The quarrel has taken an international shape. And the world is in danger. Man face one another in enmity and snare, just like cats and dogs. Sri Vishwakrishas cannot give advice to the cats and dogs, but it can deliver the message of order to men through qualified acharyas, holy teachers. The human race should take the vanished wisdom of Sri Vishwakrishas and not quarrel over material possessions. One must be satisfied with whatever he is. Are given to him by mercy of God. There can be no peace if the communist or capitalist or any other party claims proprietorship over the resources of nature, which are entirely the property of Lord. The capitalist cannot serve the communist simply by political maneuvering, nor can communists defeat the capitalist simply by fighting for stolen bread. If they do not recognize the proprietorship on the Supreme Personality of Godhead, all the property they claim to be their own is stolen. Consequently, they will be liable to punishment by the laws of nature. Nuclear bombs are in the hands of both communists and capitalists. And if both do not recognize the proprietorship of Supreme Lord, it is certain that these bombs will ultimately ruin both parties. Thus, in order to save themselves and bring peace to the world, both parties must follow the instruction of Sri Vishwakrishas.
Sri Srila Prabhupada, when he wrote Vishwakrishas, he was practically unknown person. When he was practicing, actually Vishwakrishas, Prabhupada wrote as a series of articles in Back to Godhead Mexico. When he was back to Godhead, pioneer years, 1944, that time. And then eventually that was serialized as a book, that was made into a book by the devotees. So at that time, Prabhupada was unknown. And still, you know, he's writing as Acharya, instructing communists and capitalists what you should do and what you should not do. The Prabhupada understands that I am not alone, such a man, external sincere. The Krishna's instructions are for everyone. So now, another principle here is that the Acharya illustrates eternal principles with contextual examples. The Acharya illustrates eternal principles. The eternal principle is that there should be the proprietorship of God. But he will illustrate it through contextual examples. So somebody will say that, okay, now communism is practically dead. So this is always relevant to us. Because now the capital, now communist US has fallen. And although China is communist, China is a nominally communist, but China has adopted more as a capitalist model of economy, while retaining the communist model of government. So in that sense, there is no battle between communists and capitalists. So does that mean that this purport has become irrelevant? No. See, the principle is eternal. And the examples will be contextual. And the contextual examples may sometimes become irrelevant after some time. But we have to understand that it's the principle. So, see, yeah, yesterday we were discussing about Pratyaksha Anuman. So, about how Pratyaksha Anuman can also be used in the service of Shabda. So, when we use Pratyaksha Anuman in the service of Shabda, then we can get realization, isn't it? I explained realization means what? To harmonize our Anuman, to harmonize our Pratyaksha, to do Anuman is to harmonize our Pratyaksha with Shabda. So, basically, using Pratyaksha Anuman. Sometimes an Acharya may also give example from Pratyaksha Anuman to explain Shabda. But the nature of Pratyaksha Anuman is that they are changeable. And because Pratyaksha Anuman are changeable, that doesn't mean that the principle of Shabda is changeable. So, Srila Prabhupada talks about, for example, women as less intelligent. And this is one of the very sensitive topics to talk about. But Prabhupada illustrates it very beautiful. Prabhupada, he was in America, it was completely fearless. He spoke in one city about how women are less intelligent. They are less intelligent because they have a smaller brain. And then he came to, I think that was in Chicago, and then he came over and came to Philadelphia. Philadelphia is Prajna Sarupo's temple, no?
Yeah.
So when he came there, Prajna Sarupo was also there, and just two reporters had come because they had heard this, and both of them were females. You know, the journalist and the photographer. So, Swamiji, you say that women are less intelligent than men? Yes. And you say that the problems of the world are because women are not subordinate to men? Yes. And she was going on asking, Prabhupada was completely uncompromising. And then, you know, the woman, so Prabhupada was saying that the woman's brain is smaller than men's brain, that's why women are less intelligent, the women should be subordinate. And then, so, behind all the devotee Maharaj becomes a little nervous. And then Vishakhavadani came to Shri, after the whole interview got over, Vishakhavadani came to Prabhupada. And she came to Prabhupada, she was like, Prabhu, Prabhupada, you know, all the Prabhus are telling us that we are less intelligent because we have a smaller brain. I said, Prabhupada gave a broad smile. He said, oh, when you become a devotee, your brain grows.
So, and Raja Sarupo heard this and he started to realize that Prabhupada is actually, now you cannot say scientifically that this had an expression of brain will grow in a physical sense.
Prabhupada is talking about a higher principle and give you a contextual example for that. So now, it is not, at that time when Srila Prabhupada studied in Scottish Church College, there was a theory going on that the female brain is smaller than the male brain. And that's what Srila Prabhupada took. And he excused that scientific finding. In fact, he quoted on Bhagavatam purport also. According to the research of so and so scientist, the female brain is smaller than the male brain. Now, subsequent findings indicate that that is not always true. That, you know, there is no symmetrical relationship between gender and brain size. So sometimes the female brain may be bigger than the male brain, sometimes the female brain may be the same size, sometimes it will be smaller size. And of course, a lot depends on the size of the person also. You know, if a fat female will have a bigger brain than a thin male. But even if you have a big brain physically, that does not mean that a person is big intellectually. So there are so many factors over here. So now somebody may ask you that according to science, it's not true that females have smaller brains than male brains. That's fine. So what we are doing is, our purpose is to establish Shabda. And wherever Pratyaksha Anuman gives the findings to agree with Shabda, use them. Our attitudes to Pratyaksha Anuman is the attitude of Yukta Vairagya. We are attached to Pratyaksha Anuman. If you can use them, use them. If you can't, use it. So, this example is illustrated. Suppose we are going to the program by a car and the car breaks down. Now, your purpose is not to be attached to the car, your purpose is to go to the program. But the car is useful for going to the program. So if you find that the car is broken down, you have two alternatives. One is fix the car, second is change the car. but your purpose remains unchanged to go for the purpose. So like that, our purpose is to help people develop faith in Shabda. And going to that program by the car is like using Pratyaksha Anuman for that purpose. So when we use Pratyaksha Anuman, sometimes Pratyaksha Anuman will break up. Now in Lilamrut there is one prediction which Prabhupada made. Prabhupada said, by 2000, nobody will be living on the surface. There will be so much shortage and so much expansion that everybody will have to go underground. Now, he said 2000 is coming, that will not happen. So did Prabhupada make a wrong prophecy? No. In another conclusion Prabhupada quotes that actually according to, what is it, some survey done by somebody. So there was a well respected survey which was going around at that time, and according to so and so survey, actually the way human society is expanding, nobody will have a place to live on land. So Prabhupada is simply quoting that survey. Sometimes Prabhupada quotes, according to a prominent astrologer, Nehru has reincarnated as a dog in Switzerland. In Sweden. So now Prabhupada is simply quoting mundane authority. So now Jayapataka Maharaj asked Prabhupada about this. Prabhupada gave a beautiful example. Prabhupada said, if there is one point, you can draw unlimited lines to it. But if you have 2 points, how many lines can you draw? Only one line. 3 points? Only one line. He said, so Acharya is like 1 point. So the Acharya will speak something, but people can interpret his words in many different ways. Therefore, you have to see the words of the Acharya in the context of the teaching. When you see the continuity, you will understand there is only one school of thought. There is one thought that is being propagated about it. So therefore, when an Acharya is speaking, an Acharya also speaks many different things. So when Acharya is repeating Guru, Sadhu, Shastra, or other when Acharya is directly speaking Shastra, that has one level of authority, and the Acharya is quoting from mundane sources, is using mundane Pratyaksha and Anuman to support Shastra. That is another level of authority. So now this particular example of communist and capitalist fighting, that is Shastric principle illustrated through contextual examples. So because it is illustrated through contextual examples, when the context change, the example will no longer be valid. So what has not changed is the principle. Therefore, we have to see this dynamic. And so now Srila Prabhupada may say that women have less brain than men. Subsequently, scientists say that is not true. That doesn't mean Prabhupada is making a mistake. Prabhupada is telling the scriptural principle that women are less than children. Now what is the essence of that principle? That actually in the female body, the soul's attachment to the body is much greater than the male body. Because for the soul, the whole sense of self-worth and self-identity comes from the body in the female body. So that's why that body misidentification is considered a kind of legend thesis. Body misidentification also leads to a lot of emotionality as contrasted with rationality. So, now the principle is women are less intelligent. But the example is contextual. That is, women have smaller reason. The context may change, so that contextual example may not be valid. But that doesn't mean that it's possible to be valid. But differentiate between the two. Is this point clear? Yes.
On which date and in which place a particular quote of Prabhupada has been written, Bhava Sampal quote or Bhava Gita quote?
Yes, the archives are there, Uttaran archives are there, that they have kept the audio of Prabhupada also is available. They also have the transcript which is originally done from the audio. Then they also now Jayadev Maharaj and the BBD is trying to make a full website showing all that happened on the purpose. For example, this is the transcription there. So they already have made a website, the beginning series. Or BBDedit.com, I think. BBDedit. Yeah, BBDedit.com. So what it is? They have the audio, what Prabhupada spoke. They have the first transcript. The first transcript may contain some mistakes, because the devotee didn't know transcript properly. Then Prabhupada was saying Pitra Loka, in the first Bhagavad Gita there is Triloka. Triloka. Now, where in the universe is Triloka? Nowhere. So that treated as a mistake. That is correct to me. And then they are making a systematic plan to put all that on the BBT website. But it's act, if somebody wants it, it's accessible. From the BBT archives, we can get it.
Is someone editing the example also, the contextual example, as you said, which is good? Good,
good.
Is someone changing the example, editing the example
also, as you said,
the example
is changing the contextual? Can I change the example because the context is changing? That cannot be changed. Because what the author has written is what the author has written. Now, there are also some proposals to put footnotes to explain certain controversial or difficult concepts, but that concept of that was also not accepted by the people. So we can't change that, because the Prabhupada's one is Prabhupada's one. That's why Prabhupada also told his disciples to write books explaining his books. So for example now, what traditional Buddhist studies in his essence of Bhagavad Gita is Siddhi Dharma, what a youth of spirituality from one with Siddhi. Take an essential theme from the Bhagavad Gita, put them in context. After Samad Maharaj is working on what we have a essence of Bhagavad Gita for, he's trying to make that entirely based on Prabhupada's words. It's very difficult, that means if you want to write about avatars. So, try to collect everything that Prabhupada has said everywhere in avatar, and then put it in a flow, put it in a structure. So that entirely is Prabhupada's words. So every theme of the Bhagavad Gita, everything that Prabhupada has said in the soul, collect that and then put that in order. So I saw what he was doing. It was enormous hard work. Because when you want to put in a structure, then Prabhupada said different things in different places and they are in different contexts. So to bring them into structure is not easy. But if it is done, then that can become like a standard textbook for all his concourses and his devotees. So in the systematic theology of Srila Prabhupada, that's the theme of that course. So we can't change it, but we can surely arrange it thematically. Now very few people actually go back and read the books of the Acharyas. For example, in the Ramanuja Sampradaya, there was one scholar of the Ramanuja Sampradaya, maybe 40-50 years ago, he wrote a book called Yatindra Mata Darshan. So he has made a thematic presentation of the teachings of Ramanuja. Now very few current scholars will go and read all the original writings of Ramanujan. They just go and study the thematic analysis. So then, in the thematic presentation, whatever the contextual things Ramanujan has said, they will not be there, but the entire things will be there. We can't rewrite Prabhupada books. That would be wrong, because the author is not there. Nobody else can change what the author is done. And he's not the ordinary author. See, that's wrong, even from the moral point of view, to change the author's words. And what to speak of Acharya and Acharya's words.
This one thing with Chaitanya's is that certain words are there, like kind, etc., whose meaning have changed when Prabhupada wrote. And previously, like you see that Shakespeare writings are there. Now there are books, separate books which are explaining the meaning of certain words that were there. He said that you may ask certain books.
Separate books, I do not change this particular example. So now, yes, that is correct. Prabhupada uses the word cult very often, and cult was basically meaning a group. But basically, cult has now changed to something which is a very close-minded cabal which brainwashes and indoctrinates and exploits people. That is the meaning. A classic and tragic example of misunderstanding of word is that rape code, third canto. So Prabhupada says that women like men who are expert at rape. Prabhupada says one person. Now, actually, there is a quote of Prabhupada like that, and it's very volatile. Because this is what is generally portrayed in pornography. That actually, when a man abuses a woman, although she may protest, actually she is happy with that. And this increases crimes against women. And because this is a very, very horrible misrepresentation. That's what the women's rights activists say. They say that nobody likes to be raped. They say that women like. Now, you see, Prabhupada is not saying women like to be raped. Prabhupada is saying women like men who are expert at rape. Naturally, rape doesn't require any expertise. What expertise will require in rape? Isn't it? So when devotee showed me, they are putting on the website also, they showed actually how the meanings of English words change. And Prabhupada learned his English in 1920s. Early, not in 19, yeah. 1929 and 1920. So at that time the word rape did not mean physical violation of some other woman who is not married. It means aggression within love. That was the meaning of it. Aggression within love, that means when a husband and wife are there together, but the wife is just acting contrary. And at that time the marriage is aggressive. That happens, you know, Radharani is shy and Krishna is approaching and Krishna forcibly embraces Radharani. This aggression within love. So now, that's what Srila Prabhupada is. And if you look at the previous and subsequent purpose and the context, I think this is the Pachini Parishad. Now, what is the passage? Purunjaya passage. So, you know, it's very clear that what Prabhupada is meaning is not rape in the normal sense. As I said, Prabhupada is not saying, women like to be raped, nor is he saying that, you know, that he's using the word exploitatory. And no expert is required, you know, all that is required is brute force. No expert. So, Prabhupada is saying, so if there is aggression within love, and the woman is shy or contrary, then the man expertly wins her around. That is what Prabhupada is talking about. So, that can be very jolting for people sometimes. When people read that. So that sort of thing essentially happens. Words change their meanings. Another example, more secular example, is gay. Now I had gone for a gay party. Earlier gay just meant cheerful. Isn't it? But now gay means something entirely different. So words do change their meanings. Okay. Now incidentally, actually there is no quote of Prabhupada directly saying that my books are law books for the Gandhaka's only. As only one quote which was made to one disciple in private. Prabhupada has not written anywhere in his books that my books are law books for them. Yes, what he has said is going to be the principles which are going to be there in the 10,000 years of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's golden period. But that doesn't mean that his books, literally letters, had to be the law. The principles that are told, they are going to govern society. So, we shouldn't. No, I am not saying that Prabhupada's books will not be the law. I am saying that we cannot take the letter of the law and forget the spirit of the law. That will be sensitive to the context. Yes. So then Prabhupada finally raised this point. They start talking about contextual examples and eternal principles. But what Prabhupada is saying is nuclear bombs. You can destroy. See, modern society, the destructive capacity is so much. Last time we had Janmashtami. The police had come to our temple. They said that your temple is on the terror radar. Why? Because several reasons. It's a cantonment area. So it's a military area. So if you can attack those in the military area, it's like an insult to the military and military. On top of that, it was an international society. On top of that, it's a Hindu society. On top of that, foreigners come here. So it's very high on the terror radar. And they said, now, you know, a small mobile. Nowadays they don't even use nuclear bombs, they have got chemical bombs. A small mobile can contain enough destructive power that it can throw, when it explodes, it can throw poisonous germs in an area of 6 miles. And people will die. Because of either the poisonous chemicals or the lethal germs. One tiny mobile, it explodes, it looks like a mobile. So this is what modern science has done is that it has used to do scientific advancement required sattvic intelligence. Understand actually nature. Some intelligence is required. But that sattvic intelligence is used with rajasic controlling mentality to further tamasic destruction. So it's a spiral going downwards. That's what Prabhupada is warning. When you have destructive weapons, so you use your intelligence in sattvic and for what purpose? For tamasic control. And terror is what they want to do, they want to control, but they think you can't control, and whoever else is controlling will destroy. That's how technology can be taken. And what is the solution to this? Solution is going to the root. One thing we have to counter the terrorists practically, but more importantly, the root is the foolish ideology. Where people think of my land and your land and don't acknowledge God's proprietorship.
Let's go. We'll complete this part.
The okay.
Human beings, sorry.
Fast.
Human beings are not meant.
Human beings are not meant to quarrel like cats and dogs.
you must be intelligent enough to realize the importance of human life. The Vedic literature is meant for humanity and not for cats and dogs. Cats and dogs can kill other animals for food without suffering state. But if a man kills an animal for the satisfaction of his uncontrolled taste buds, he is responsible for breaking the laws of nature. Consequently, he must be punished.
So now this is the next time, Prabhupada is telling over here, the quota, example of quota in human diet. So Prabhupada will now talk about how vegetarianism is not all that glorious.
The standard of life for human beings cannot be applied to animals. The tiger does not eat rice and wheat or drink cow's milk, because he has been given food in the shape of animal flesh. Among the many animals and birds, some are vegetarians, others are carnivorous. But none of them can accept the law of nature is ordained by the will. Lord. Animals, birds, reptiles, and other lower life forms strictly adhere to the laws of nature. Therefore, there is no question of sin for them, nor are the Vedic injunctions meant for them. Human life alone is a life of responsibility.
So, the struggle for existence is a truth of nature. What Darwin talked about is the struggle for existence and survival of the fittest. They are truths, but they are material truths, they are not spiritual truths. In a sense, all of us have a dual nature. We are spirit souls in material bodies. And the material body has certain cravings, certain longings, certain passions, and the soul has a different set of longings and desires. So now, survival of the fittest is the truth at the body level. But survival of the fittest is not a noble truth. See, if a person is drowning and somebody jumps in to rescue that drowning person, that drowning person is weak and rescuing person is strong. So, when he rescues him, where is survival of the fittest? So, a noble civilization is based not on survival of the fittest, but rather protection of the unfit.
Varnashram Dharma, all the five societies are five kinds of people. Who are the five people who are protected?
Cows,
children, women and Brahmins. And you see, old men.
So you see, from the material point of view, they are not fit. The cow, cow doesn't have actually any defense mechanism. It can't run very fast. It has bomb. It doesn't have very strong teeth for attacking or killing.
So, survival of fittest may be a fact of nature, but it is not a desirable or noble fact of nature. The higher spiritual nature will mean not survival of fittest, but rather protection by the fittest. Those are the fittest, they should protect others.
Darwin's theory, you just can't explain this. So why are people ready to risk their lives to protect the lives of others? And not only do they risk lives, they glorify others, glorify those who do that. When the WBC disaster happened, the firemen went inside and they risked their lives to protect to rescue the people over there. And all of America was applauding them. Why would we do that?
Social service, humanitarian work, that a person is ready to sacrifice his own heart and money for giving food to others. If survival of the fittest was the defining principle of nature and we are a part of nature, then all that is noble and valued in human society and culture would need to be pointless. Therefore, survival of the fittest is a principle at the body level. But it is a principle just like eating, sleeping, making, defending are natural at the body level. But when we rise to higher level of consciousness, we curtail. So like that, survival of fittest is a principle at the body level. But the more noble and selfless a society becomes, the more elevated a person becomes in his consciousness, the more a person sacrifices. So we will discuss this elaborately later. Srila Prabhupada was not against social service. Srila Prabhupada was against social service being equated with spiritual service, with emotional service. So we see that if survival of fittest was the argument, Francis Bacon, why is he giving up his own life?
you know, for some low caste people. Why is Shivaji Maharaj giving up his life for some birds? And so, survival of the fittest is important. There is some higher principle over here. So, that is, supposing humans are not meant to quarrel like cats and dogs. Cats and dogs, they'll quarrel. Because they are just going to be governed by nature. But humans should live according to higher principles, not just base instincts. So human life alone is a life of responsibility. Now what does responsibility mean? Responsibility, as we know. So, you know, all of us, we have certain stimulus which comes to us. And we have some default responses to them. Default responses. But we check those default responses and bring out the desired responses. That is responsibility. So if we just consider ourselves to be a body, then as soon as a male body sees a female body, the stimulus comes in, the default response is, I want to enjoy. But if there is culture, then there is responsibility. And the desired response is, it's a matter. So, we subordinate the instincts and bring out the higher principle responses. Now, Prabhupada explains this with respect to the diet now. And go ahead, just quickly complete this. A couple of paragraphs.
It is wrong, however.
It is wrong, however, to think by simply by becoming a vegetarian one can avoid transgressing the law. Vegetables also have life. And while it is nature's law that one living being is meant to feed on another, for human beings the point is to recognize the Supreme Lord. That one should not be proud of being a strict vegetarian. Animals do not have developed consciousness by which to recognize the Lord. But a human being is sufficiently intelligent to take lessons from the living literature and thereby know how the laws of nature are working and derive profit out of such knowledge.
Sometimes some people would come and tell, probably they are vegetarian. Probably the monkeys are vegetarian. What is so great about that?
So,
this is nice. It's a step towards the elevation of global consciousness and individual consciousness. But Prabhupada wants to take us much higher.
Go ahead.
If a man neglects the instructions of the Vedic literature, his life becomes very risky. A human being is therefore required to recognize the authority of the Supreme Lord and become his devotee. He must offer everything for the Lord's service and partake only of the remnants of food offered to the Lord. This will enable him to discharge his duty properly. The Bhagavad Gita 9.26. The Lord directly states that he accepts vegetarian food from the hands of a pure devotee. Therefore, a human being should not only become a strict vegetarian, but should also become a devotee of the Lord. Offer the Lord all his food and then partake of such prasadam on the mercy of God. Only those who act in this way can properly discharge the duties of human life. Those who do not offer their food to the Lord eat nothing but sin and subject themselves to various kinds of distress which are the results of sin.
So, Srila Prabhupada is talking about first month, rising from non-vegetarian to vegetarian and from vegetarian to becoming a devotee and offering, taking offered food. Now, again, protection and anumani to use is an important point. We are discussing, often we give examples of how the human system is more similar to a vegetarian system than a non-vegetarian system. And that's how we humans should be vegetarians. Now, factually, there are many similarities between the human system and non-vegetarian system also. One of them is that Prabhupada mentioned another support that for those who want to eat meat, they have been given two canine meat, by which you can cut and eat flesh. So, biologically speaking, the human system is not vegetarian. It is what we call as omnivorous. Like cats can eat milk as well as plants. Whereas humans can digest meat as well as grains. So humans, strictly speaking biologically, we are omnivorous. But if you look at it, out of our teeth, how many are canine? Very few. So two here, two there, four. Yes. So we have very few canine teeth. And if you look at it, our system is more similar to vegetarian than non-vegetarian. So biologically, humans can eat meat if they want, but
that the system is not made only for eating meat or primarily for eating meat. So, unfortunately in our society, meat has become a staple diet for me. And that is undesirable at the very broth level. So, Vedic culture, you have to always remember that Srila Prabhupada is giving us not just Vedic culture. Srila Prabhupada is giving us the best of Vedic culture. So, in the Vedic literature, there are many references to eating meat. In fact, the very incarnation of Buddha happened because too many animals were being killed in the name of Vedic culture. That means Vedic culture, who talk about meat eating? Or killing animals and eating the meat. So, that's not wrong in the sense of it being sanctioned by Vedic literature. But it is not a recommendation of Vedic literature, it is a concession. And for those who want to advance, meat eating should be given up. But Srila Prabhupada is not just talking about that. Prabhupada is talking about to go beyond meat eating to offering food and taking Krishna prasadam. Yes, ma'am?
3.14, four kinds of food for Bhagavan.
In 17 chapter.
15.14.
No, that Chamyan Jatavidam is different. That is food, everything in the morning, Mangalati of Chatavidashi Bhagavat Prasada. That is food just to be tasted, which is to be licked, which is to be sucked, which is to be swallowed, which is to be chewed.
So, I assume of those four kinds is.
No, that's got nothing to do with vegetarian food. That is just different kinds of delicacies. Actually, all of them are vegetarian only, mostly. Right. The point which I am making here is that, you know, by protection and anuman, you cannot prove anything. There are Muslims who are, there is one Muslim preacher who goes around and says how vegetarian food is a natural food. And he will give biological charts. And he will show. And he will refute him biologically. And he will come back and refute biologically also. So we don't depend only on protection and anuman. But it's a valid case. That for some body system, especially if it is eaten too much. So, at a higher level of spiritual evolution, at a higher consciousness, one should give up vegetarian food, non-vegetarian food. Not just take vegetarian food, but take Krishna prasad. And last, Prabhupada concludes it. The root of sin, who would like to read, is a very classic statement.
The root of sin is deliberate disobedience of the laws of nature through disregarding the proprietorship of the Lord. Disobeying the laws of nature or the order of the Lord brings ruin to human being. Conversely, one who is sober, one who knows the laws of nature, and one who is not influenced by unnecessary attachment or aversion is sure to be recognized by the Lord and thus become eligible to go back to Godhead, back to eternal home.
See, the verse is just talking about recognizing proprietorship of God. The Prabhupada is taking us back to Godhead directly in the purport. The Prabhupada's genius is that every theme in scripture he connected with the ultimate goal of scripture. So Prabhupada has a systematic flow of thought by which the purport is talking about a very basic principle. Recognize the authority of God. But Prabhupada talks about recognizing the authority of God, we will live in harmony in this world and ultimately we will go back to the spiritual world. And modern society has the idea of sin. Oh, if you harm somebody, if you hurt somebody, that is sin. Prabhupada takes it down to a much more fundamental level. And sin means actually nothing belongs to us. So when we take something which belongs to others, which ultimately belongs to God, use it, then that is sin. The root of sin is deliberate disobedience of the laws of nature through disregarding the proprietorship of the Lord. So actually as devotees, we all have this in the care of. We may have certain things by our name, but we keep it in, we understand it's in our care. And to the extent we develop this principle that nothing is mine, it is just under my care, then we can do our devotional service very nicely. But we become attached to this is mine, then we say our state of principle, Tena Bhunjita. We see Prashit Maharaj was doing a very good service and he was doing it well. Very important service and doing it well. But suddenly he was holding the service. But to die in heaven, immediately he left. An example of detachment. So, this is a theme we'll discuss later. how a devotee can be both detached and responsible at the same time. We'll discuss that later. But
at this point, we just see the overview, what we discussed.
So Prabhupada started by talking about how Vedic knowledge is infallible and it is eternal principle, like the principle of proprietorship of God. And then, how is the proprietor? Based on Bhagavad analysis and based on his energy he explains. Then he talks about how, what is ours to take? It's a quota. So in nature he gives the example of cows, and within human society he talks about how, because of disregarding this principle, there is fighting between communists and capitalists. And then he talks about how, so it is one is example of nature, second is example of human interaction, third is human nature interaction. That you know, we should not kill other animals for our food, rather we should take the human food. No, and not just human nature, we have human nature, God, all three interactions there, right?
Offering it back to God.
So thank you very much. Sri Shobhishad ki, Sri Prabhupada ki, Gauri Bhakti Rabbi ki, Charles.